Good morning, Mr. Olson.
Morning, Chief Judge Sintel. May it please the court. In this case, the government contractor, SAIC, submitted admittedly, concededly correct and accurate claims for payment on government-prepared forms for fully performed, high-quality services. Yet the government seeks a $6.5 million punitive award under the False Claims Act, which is 83,000 times the $78 nominal damages the jury awarded. The government's positions we submit supporting this extravagant recovery are not only inconsistent with the precedents of the Supreme Court and of this court and other courts of appeals, but would allow the government to seek and private citizens under the QI-TAM provisions limitless recoveries when a government contractor has honestly performed the services expected of it under the contract. The government takes the position, it takes a new position in this court, that a submission of a false statement, even if there is no false claim, is in and of itself enough to establish liability under the false.
Do you want us to reject the implied certification theory?
We submit that the implied certification theory is weak. Other courts have questioned it. I would think
we've assumed that it works, right? In TDC-1 and TDC-2, we've assumed
have
it
In the CYWIC case, you have, and the Second Circuit has followed that specifically under the explicit understanding that there is an express certification requirement in a statute, regulation, or contract.
We'll get to the Second Circuit one later, but are you asking us to reject the implied certification theory?
I think it is weak and is bad law, Judge Griffith, because
you didn't seem to argue that with the same fervor that that you argued other points, and that's
well,
just what
I thought your point was that the implied certification theory depends on a requirement that that it be a condition of actual payment.
Yeah.
And
yes.
That if it is, then the implied certification theory works. Isn't that your theory?
It certainly doesn't work without that.
Right.
And that's what I think this court said in CYWIC. You have
to say it works if it works at all only in that circumstance.
Exactly, Judge Sintel. And so, Judge Griffith, I'm saying that I think it's not a good requirement because government contracts need to know that when they submit claims, that the claims themselves stand for what they've done. But this court and other courts have accepted that theory under those restrictions. And that's the argument that we've made, and we've made that forcefully because that's the law of this court as articulated in the CYWIC case.
Well, let me ask you about CYWIC, okay? I can see there's some language in there that you've quoted that does seem to support this, but in CYWIC, or CYWIC, as I read the case, there was no requirement that the contractor certify compliance with Section 207 there. I mean, Section 207, wasn't that what it was? Section 207, right?
It was.
Was not part of the contract at all. There was no requirement that the contractor certify compliance with it. Whereas here, the contract requires certification of no conflicts. It's built into the actual contract so that CWAC really didn't have to decide the question of whether it needs to be an express condition of payment, right? Because it wasn't even a condition of the contract.
Well, it was, but the court specifically did say that it is something that had to be an express, it had to be a requirement of certification, that when you're making a certification, the statute, regulation, or contract would say that that's what you were certifying to.
Well, but it did. It did say in one point it must be a condition of payment. But it also said, it says, He said, excuse me, it says, courts have been ready to enforce certification, but only when certification was a prerequisite to the government action, right? It's not payment, but just the government action.
Well,
namely, it could be viewed as the contract. And in that case, the court didn't really have to resolve the issue that's here because 207 wasn't a requirement of that contract at all. That's my point. Isn't that right?
I accept that up
okay.
to a point.
Yeah.
There is, in this contract, if you look at Joint Appendix 10, 57, 58, and so forth,
right.
there are 21 representations, certifications, statements, which are put into these contracts. It's not at all unusual, as you know,
right.
Judge Tatel, in government contracts
right,
for
right.
the contract to include practically everything. This one included certifications with respect to the Clean Air Act,
right.
the Clean Water Act, a drug-free environment, and so forth. What I think the court said in CIWAC or CWAC is that there must be some clarity. When in this case, the contractor performed the services that were required of it. The government accepted those services. It even paid for those services. There were payments made after the disclosure of these issues about conflicts, organizational conflicts of interest. The government said it was high-quality services.
Right, I understand all that. And in the end, I mean, your theory may be right. I'm just questioning whether CWAC binds us here, whether CWAC, in fact, resolves this issue. That's the only question I'm asking.
Well, I would say this.
Yeah.
First of all, the court said in CWAC the implicit certification thing is a non-starter.
Well,
then the court goes on to say that if it is only under the circumstances where certification of compliance creates liability when certification is a prerequisite to obtaining a government benefit.
Right.
I don't think it's reasonable to construe that as a condition to entering into the contract. I think it is.
Well, the cases it cites are that kind of case. The Ninth Circuit case it cites and these other cases, I don't remember that any of them depended on it being a condition of payment. They all said it had to be a condition of the contract.
But those cases were not cases where it was a condition to the award of the contract. It was,
uh-huh.
I think, a fair reading of those cases is that it was in the context of someone seeking a payment. After all, we're talking about the False Claims Act here, and the question is the statute requires that there be a false claim. Not, by the way, what the government says, that there's a representation unconnected with any false claim. That, which is in the government's brief, is a false claim itself, to make that argument about the False Claims Act.
Perhaps you can bring a key tam on that one.
Then we'd have an interesting argument about the size of the damages, Your Honor. But the statute unquestionably requires is a false claim. So what this is about, this whole implied certification or implicit certification argument, is what makes the claim false. The government takes the position, and the court instructed the jury here, that any withholding or failure to disclose any information that was critical to the government's decision to pay, that would convert the False Claims Act into something like 10b-5 or something.
Yeah, but not in this case, right? I mean, because there's evidence that there were employees who knew of the conflict of interest, and there's no question that the contract here, that was an important term of the contract here, right? That there were no conflicts of interest.
Presumably all of these provisions, these 21 requirements, are incorporated into the contract. Secondly, Judge Griffith, the testimony was that the employees thought, and they were advised by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission twice, in 1992 and in 1999, that the Department of Energy was a separate entity of government. There was a firewall between the NRC and the Department of Energy. The NRC calls itself an independent regulatory agency. The government does so in its brief in this court. The SAIC, when it entered into these contracts, was concerned. It knew it had DOE contracts or contracts with people doing business at the Department of Energy. It twice, and the record is quite clear on this, it twice raised the question, what about the Department of Energy? The Nuclear Regulatory Commission said, don't worry about the Department of Energy. That's a separate entity. Now, at best, That makes the issue about organizational conflicts of interest in these situations a plausible understanding, a reasonable understanding of the individuals. And furthermore, that so-called knowledge depends upon the collective knowledge theory, the court instructed.
Is that right? I thought there were some employees who were aware of this and also who were aware of the contract with the NRC and were also aware of the conflicts that are existing. Am I wrong on that?
You're correct that some employees knew about the DOE, the relationship with right. DOE contractors, not with DOE, subcontractors right. and so forth, and also aware of the NRC. That one, the Bechtel-Jacobs contract, right. for example, the NRC itself knew that that work was being done over at the Department of Energy. In fact, they specifically asked that the information.
Your argument is that, so even if we agree with you that the collective knowledge instruction perhaps is inadequate, does that resolve the case for you, or isn't there another standard that we could use to still find liability if in fact there are employees who knew of the NRC contract, the provision of the contract, and knew of the conflict?
Well, no, because if the understand of what they knew, they did not interpret and reasonably or plausibly, to use the language of this court in KNR, believed that that was not a conflict of interest, then there should not be liability on that basis as well. There were a number of...
But if we thought it was implausible for them to have that construction, then you lose on that.
Well, we don't lose because of various different provisions.
But on that issue, you lose.
Suppose
well,
there was...
May I reserve...
Sure, not well.
Subject to answering the court's questions.
Actually, I have two. I have two questions. Suppose there was absolutely no ambiguity about the testimony or even its plausibility. I mean, just suppose, for example, in this case, there was clear testimony from employees indicating they knew that the contract prohibited conflicting relationships, okay? And also that there were employees who knew, same employees, knew that the company, that these relationships were in fact prohibited conflicts, okay? And that the company had certified that it didn't have any. So under your theory, the government couldn't pursue that case on the False Claims Act, right?
That is not a False Claims Act case. That the government may have other remedies. It may terminate the contract. It may debar the contractor. It may sue. It did sue in this case for breach of contract.
Okay, but even with the facts assumed to be true as I stated, it's not a False Claims Act
case,
right?
It's not a false claim because...
Okay. Right. I understand you. Yeah. Because... Go ahead, finish your sentence. Sorry.
Because it is the claim that was submitted uh-huh. doesn't include... those other things, unless the government decides, which it may, to make that an express condition or express prerequisite.
Let me ask you one question about the damages question. And I see your point about the instruction. If we agree with you, how would the district court or the jury go about, how would you decide what the damages were? I mean, services were provided. The government says, well, they were infected with the conflict. And I understand your point about the instruction, but just as a mechanical matter, how, if we agreed with you, what would the parties have to show on this,
well,
on a remand?
What would you do? Bornstein court requires uh-huh. the parties to show. The Bornstein, which is the Supreme Court decision,
right.
that is binding on this court, of course,
yes.
that the difference between the market value of what the government received versus the value of what the government ought to have received under the contract. Here, that issue, in sense, went to the jury. The jury decided that there were no damages. $78.
No, I totally understand that. I got that. But what, and assuming you're totally right about it, what, the jury has to have evidence to be able to make that decision, right? Some testimony. So what would it be? How would you... Well, how would you go about showing, if this goes back on this issue, that A, the work had value, and B, that it was not infected by the conflict? Because you agree that if it was infected by the conflict, then the government didn't get what it paid for, right?
Well, let me answer the question without agreeing that there was a... I accept your premise.
You assume there was a conflict.
The government, the on pages 54 through 57 of our opening brief, that evidence is summarized. The government acknowledged that the product was excellent, that the product was something that they used.
But did it know at that time that there was a conflict?
Pardon me?
Did it know at that time that there
this
was...
This is the testimony at the trial. The product was valuable. Subsequent, the right. government's expert, the contract agency itself said that the work performed was the opposite of a conflict of interest. That was in the record. Mm-hmm. And the subsequent contractors that came in used that material for the basis for what they went forward with. So the evidence was pretty clear. Mm-hmm. That's how we would try to prove it. In a sense, the court prohibited all of that evidence from coming in, but a lot of it did come in, and it's in those pages of the brief.
Thank you. That's all I had. Yeah.
Thank you, counsel. We use your time up. We'll give you back a couple of minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Hear from the appellee.
Your Honors, may it please the court. My name is Thomas Bondi. I represent the appellee, the United States. Your Honors, from our point of view, this is a classic False Claims Act case. SAIC contracted with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to provide advice regarding potential regulatory approaches with respect to the release and recycling of radioactive materials from nuclear sites. In connection with that contract, SAIC made multiple express representations that it had no organizational conflicts of interest. Those representations were false. At the time that SAIC was seeking to obtain this contract, at the time it was performing under the contract, and at the time that it was collecting payments under the contract, SAIC had business relationships with industry members whose activities were the very subject of the regulation.
Is it the government's position, then, that any false statement by a contractor with the government brings it under the False Claims Act? I'm not hearing you describe a classic false claim. I heard you say this was a classic False Claims Act, but I haven't heard you mention any false claims that were submitted.
Well, the classic false claim, what this
question... classic false claim is, we had 800 man hours on this, and it's a cost-plus contract, and they actually only had 100 man hours. I mean, that's a classic false claim.
Your Honor, what this court said in the TDC case is the essence of a false claim is when an entity like SAIC, in this case, demands payment from the government, and at the same time withholds information critical to the government's payments decision. That's what happened here.
Let me take you back to the question I asked. Or is it the government's position that any false statement by a government contractor renders that contractor liable under the False Claims Act?
I think it has to be a false statement for the purpose of getting a false claim paid. This has to be with
respect. Getting a claim paid.
And here you have statements and you have claims. You have 17 false statements and 60
false claims. Yeah, but those false statements weren't made in connection with this particular claim.
No.
They were separate.
Of course they were, Your Honor.
They were? I thought they were the separate certifications.
I'm not sure what you mean by separate, Your Honor.
Well, was it in the request for payment?
No, but
that's
what he means by separate.
Well, Your Honor, Your Honor, if SAIC's argument is that the problem here is that the false statements weren't stapled to the invoices, if that's the argument.
Their whole argument is, as I understand their case, their entire argument is that in order to be covered by the Act, the false statement has to be in the claim for payment. That's their argument, right?
If that's their argument, I'm not aware of any authority for that. The false statement
has... Do you doubt that that's their argument? Seriously, that's what I thought their argument was.
That may well be, Your Honor.
But you seem to think it was in your brief, that was their argument. And as I understood the government's argument, it doesn't have to be in the actual claim for payment because there's evidence here that employees knew about the obligation with respect to contracts and knew they had conflicted relationships and that therefore... the claim was false. Do I have the issue right?
Yes, Your Honor, and okay. I think you've accurately characterized the government's
position. So, therefore, under their theory, the separate false statements that were false claims that the company made, that the jury found made, none of them are relevant because they weren't in the request for payment, right?
Well, that's not our position, Your Honor.
I know it's not your position, but that's their position. And the question is, what's your answer to that? Now, one answer I saw in your brief was TDC, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And your position is, as I understand it, that TDC resolves this issue, that it says that the false claim doesn't have to be in the claim for payment so long as there's a certification based on knowledge that there's a violation of the contract, right?
That would be true, Your Honor. But the false...
No, I want to ask you about TDC, okay? I don't see... Show me where... Explain to me how TDC resolves... TDC resolves this issue. I mean, I see the discussion you're citing, but I didn't see any discussion in the case of this precise issue. That is, whether the false claim had to be in the... I said it backwards before. That is, whether the requirement that there be no conflicts be in the requirement for payment. In other words, be a condition of payment, right?
I'm not sure the TDC specifically addresses that point.
Well, that's exactly my point. It doesn't. And in your brief, you say this case resolves the issue. And I'm glad to hear you say that because I didn't see it either.
Your Honor, what TDC says, and we think it applies directly here, is that the essence of a claim under the False Claims Act is a demand for payment made by someone who knowingly is withholding information from the government that is pertinent to the government's payment decision.
Yeah, but their argument, I'll do it once more, okay? Science Application's argument is that that's not enough, that the obligation to have no conflicts must be an actual condition of the payment.
Well, it is a condition here, Your Honor.
Of the payment?
There's a statute, there's regulation. Well, the statute, Your Honor.
Does the contract say that the government will make no payment?
It says you can't get the contract in the first place. You're not even eligible
correct.
For a contract.
I got that. I understand that.
And, Your Honor.
Let's stick with me. I understand that. They have to assure that there'll be no conflicts to get the contract. But does the contract state that there can be will be no payments if there are inappropriate conflicts?
I mean, it
does it say that?
I don't think in so many words.
It doesn't say that. But, and does anything? And I understand your argument doesn't depend on that.
Correct,
right?
Your Honor.
Okay, so where does TDC resolve that question?
I'm not sure the TDC resolves that specific question. Your Honor.
So then this is an open issue in this circuit, right?
Well, I'm not sure I'd go that far, Your Honor. Here we have...
What does resolve it then?
Well, I mean, another way of looking at it, Your Honor, is this case has exactly what this court said was missing in Seawick. In Seawick, which dealt with the 207 statute that Your Honors were discussing, the court said what was missing there and why you couldn't have False Claims Act liability was there was nothing in the contract surrounding those events there that suggested the 207 had anything to do with eligibility for the program and with the prerequisite for getting the contract. This case is the exact opposite of that. I mean, here, to get this contract in the first place and to retain the contract, SAIC had to make express representations that it had no conflicts of interest and it promised that during the life of the contract, it would disclose relationships giving rise to conflicts of interest as they arose. So the specific thing that was missing in Seawick is here. And Your Honors, in this case, we have express representations and implied representations. We have them both.
What's your express representation in a claim?
The express representations are the certifications, the express certifications by SAIC that it had no organizational conflicts of interest.
In the contracts, in the 92 and 99 contracts.
In the contract or
in the contracts and
claims, were those filed with the claims? Were those filed as part of the claims?
No, they weren't. They weren't part of the invoice.
To begin with, right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
In the contract to begin with.
Yes, and in subsequent cases.
I'm back to wondering if you're trying to make every breach of contract case into a false claim.
Oh, no, no, absolutely not, Your Honor.
You're not missing it much, counsel.
Well, among other things, Your Honor, there's obviously a materiality requirement. The false statements have to be material in the False Claims Act sense, which means they have to be capable of influencing the government's payment decision. And is hiding and lying...
Was it the payment decision, or was it the decision to enter into the contract that was influenced?
Both. Both. And we know that here, Your Honor, because there was express testimony by all the people who made the payment decisions that said that had the government known of these relationships, not only would this contract never have been issued in the first place, but no payments would have been made. And of course, we know that's true. As soon as the government found out about the relationships here, it promptly took steps to terminate the contract. But again, you can have False Claims Act liability based on express misrepresentations, just outright lies, and you can have...
That much is plain. That's easy if you're getting an express misrepresentation.
Exactly. And you have...
The condition of the payment.
Correct, Your Honor.
That is actually your classic False Claims Act.
And here we have that, and we have implied representations. And from our point of view, the other side seems to be saying, well, you can't count the statements because those aren't claims, and you can't count the claims because those aren't statements.
Not what they're saying. I think they're saying that the problem here is that the contract doesn't require compliance with the no conflict rules as a condition of payment.
Yeah.
That's their argument.
We think it does, Your Honor. We also don't think that's a requirement for false claims.
Forget that part about you don't think it's a requirement for the moment. I understand you're not, and we're not asking you to abandon that position. But the first part of your statement, we think it does. What is the basis for saying that you think it does require that?
Because these kinds of conflicts of interest, as reflected in the statute, the regulations, and the contract, go so obviously to the integrity of this whole enterprise, and they go to the heart of what the contract was all about. And everyone knew that. The testimony on
bias. That's your best answer to saying that this is a condition of payment.
Oh, well, we think...
Everybody knew this was important.
No, and
therefore,
many,
this must be a condition of payment. That,
and in, as a matter of law, Your Honor, and the courts have said this, in many cases, if not all, but in many cases, a condition of eligibility is a condition of payment. I mean, often this is how a lot of fraud happens. People commit the fraud to get in the door, so to speak. They lie about the initial eligibility for the contract.
Different questions, though. That may be actionable on some basis. That doesn't automatically mean it's actionable as a false claim.
Maybe not automatically, but here under the circumstances, given this statute, this regulation, this contract, and what the activity was all about here, these kinds of misrepresentations about organizational conflicts of interest go to the heart of what these contracts are all about. And, of course, they're material in the False Claims Act sense. Misrepresentations about conflicts of interest obviously are capable of having a natural tendency of influencing the government's payments.
Before we run you completely out of time, I want to ask your thoughts on the collective knowledge argument, please, counsel.
Sure. In this case, Your Honor, there are individual SAIC employees, and these are senior managers and executives, who testified that they, as individuals, basically had all the required pieces of knowledge. So this is not a case...
Do you have intent and knowledge in the same person? And if so, what is your best evidence of that?
Did you say intent, Your Honor?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not sure there's an intent requirement under the False Claims
Act. I'm not sure you're going to win a False Claims Act by somebody accidentally misstating.
No, not accidentally, Your
you
Honor.
You have knowledge. You have knowledge and the intent to make the statement.
Individual.
Make the representation in the same person.
Individual SAIC employees, just to give an example, testified just as one example that they knew about the BNFL contract. They knew that that contract contemplated release of materials off-site into commerce, and they knew that SAIC was consulting with NRC about regulations on that very topic. So if you make a list of the crucial pieces of knowledge, individual SAIC employees, this is their employees, testified that, yes, I had.
Are these the same people who are responsible for representations?
No.
Now we're back to the collective knowledge question then, aren't we?
Well, I mean,
if you have knowledge in some heads and you have a representation in some other mouths, then you're relying on a collective knowledge theory, aren't you?
in that sense, Your Honor, but the personnel...
That's the only sense I know of.
No, there could be... No, in this case, you can imagine if a company has, you know, hermetically sealed chambers where people within the company don't know what other people are doing.
Then you may get to willful ignorance problem.
Right. But here,
but
there's none of...
I understand the government's argument here. You seem perhaps to be relying in the district court on a collective knowledge theory that among the employees, some of them knew everything necessary to be known, some others made some representations.
Right, but it's
that,
the contract.
That sounds like a collective knowledge theory.
It's the contracting personnel, the people in charge of the contract and paperwork who sign the representations. They're not the people who do the substantive work of the company. Those people are scientists and physicists.
So are you admitting that there's nobody who both knew the had the knowledge and made the representation? Or are you denying that?
Well, the people who had the knowledge, we think, knew of the conflict of interest. I don't know if that fully answers Your Honor's question.
Were they the people who formulated the contract and sent the invoices, though?
I doubt they were the people who sent the invoices.
They formulated the contract.
You're relying on collective knowledge.
Well, in that very, very weak sense, Your Honor, those are the accounting people. They're not the people who do the substantive work of the company.
Haven't we rejected collective knowledge, at least in dicta? I understand that.
I don't think so, Your Honor.
Did you read Philip Morris?
I did, Your Honor.
Maybe the only person who read all of it. you recall, I know it's dicta, but you recall we rather nicely expressed our doubts about collective knowledge.
My understanding is that the doubts were expressed about collective intent, not collective knowledge. The knowledge of the company is the sum of the knowledge of the employees, but to go knowledge plus knowledge equals...
So how far down do we go? The sum of all the employees? You said these were senior managers here.
Yes.
How far beyond that are you willing to go under a collective knowledge?
I mean, I think in theory, all the way, but this case is an easy collective knowledge case. I mean, it really is. SAIC, the record shows, kept no secrets from itself. The key players here knew everything.
That becomes something of a problem with a big company, doesn't it? The left hand doesn't always know what the right
hand is. Well, it does, but then you get into the institutional responsibility. Aside from individual employees, the company has an institutional responsibility to ensure compliance.
That sounds like collective knowledge. And we did use the term collective knowledge and collective intent in the same sentence in Philip Morris.
Yes, but...
If there is a difference between them, I don't think it gets you very far because we did... The description included both terms.
But in any event, Your Honor, here there was substantial evidence at the trial concerning what SAIC put forth.
But if you're talking now about institutional responsibility to coordinate the left hand and the right hand,
yes,
aren't you moving into negligence?
Well, reckless disregard. But, I mean, that's another way of looking at it. But, I mean, ultimately, in a sense, we have to be relying
What's the reckless disregard? What sort of responsibility do you place upon the company for...
Well, I mean, from our point of view, a compliance...
So the company somehow gathers knowledge of all its employees before it sends out
an invoice? No, just basic things. Here, we view the conflicts of interest, frankly, as so stark and as so self-evident that a compliance...
But I'm trying to help us draw a line here. So what is the duty of the company to gather information before it sends out that invoice?
Well, just to the design of the compliance system itself has to be such so that relevant information is put into the system. And as the district court explained in its opinion here, and there was ample evidence at trial, that the system here was deficient in important respects. The district court says that in the opinion denying the post-trial motion. The system itself was on its face deficient. And
I don't want to retry the case, but because you did use the term the conflict was so stark, what is your view of the opposing party's evidence with respect to questioning whether dealing with DOE contracting entities was a conflict with NRC and whether NRC had advised to the contrary?
Your Honors, that theory is contradicted by the trial testimony of SAIC's employees. The SAIC employees that I've just been discussing testified, among other things, that they knew that when these materials are released from a DOE site, as they put it, outside the DOE fence, that's how they put it, then the materials become subject to NRC regulation. The SAIC's employees and managers testified that they knew that.
They knew that they became subject to that NRC's regulations. Does that bring that within the terms of the conflict provision if they're dealing with entities who are in the first instance subcontractors or contractors?
Oh, sure.
DOE?
Sure. I mean, SAIC...
I mean, you say sure as if that's a given. I read both briefs. They're both pretty convincing, but that isn't real consistent with describing it as sure.
I apologize, Your Honor, if I may explain very briefly. Mm-hmm. SAIC, just for example here, had a contract with BNFL that provided for BNFL to remove materials from a DOE site and to release and recycle those materials to the extent possible just into the stream of commerce. At the same time, and this is the whole ball of wax in this case, at the same time, SAIC was consulting with NRC about the regulations that would govern that very activity. I mean, SAIC was just directly on both sides of the street here. And SAIC knew it. The employees testified that they knew it. Individual employees had knowledge of both sides. I mean, the conflict itself, we think, is essentially self-evident, but of course it was undisclosed. Your Honors, I know I'm over my time.
The late Spotswood Robinson used to say that the lights control the bar, but only God can control this bench.
I want to, two things. One is, before you sit down, I want to be sure I understand the government's position. And the government's position, as I understand it, is that requests for payments are actionable under the False Claims Act, even if compliance with the no conflict rule is not a condition of payment, so long as the company knew and B, it was material, right?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay. And number two, you agree that TDC, that this is an open question in the D.C. Circuit, right?
I'm not sure I'd go that far. And again, Your Honor, we think this case.
That's what you said earlier.
Well, if I may.
I mean, because if TDC resolves it, then that makes this case a lot easier for us.
Well, I mean, TDC.
That's why I started there.
It's two things, Your Honor. TDC is very important.
But
also,
it's important,
CWIC.
But does it, that's not what I'm asking.
But with
I'm asking
CWIC,
whether it resolves the issue before us.
We think TDC and CWIC together show that this case has exactly what this court said was missing in CWIC, just exactly.
Okay, but all right, let's try once more. I agree with you that this case has what's missing in CWIC in the sense that here, complying with the no conflict rules is a condition of the contract itself, and the company was required to certify that. That was not true in CWIC. You're right about that. But the argument the company is making here is that that's not enough under the False Claims Act because the requirement not to have any conflicts has to also be a condition of payment. And that issue was not resolved in CWIC.
Again, I mean, I'm bouncing back and forth between CWIC and TDC, but here the invoices themselves stand as implied representation of any matter that is material to the government's
payment decision. Well, now you're
TDC
but,
says
but,
that.
But you see, I'll try once more, okay? Because I understand that's your theory, and you may well be right about it. I'm just trying to find out whether you really think that this issue is resolved by D.C. Circuit precedent. Or whether it's an open question for us.
I think if you put TDC and CWIC together.
Okay. Now, suppose I don't agree with you about that. Suppose I think you're wrong, that this is not resolved by those two cases. Then what's the government's argument? It's a hypothetical. Okay, don't go back to CWIC.
I understand.
Okay.
I understand, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, our argument on the merits is the same. There were express false representations here. There were implied representations.
No, forget the express ones because they weren't part of the payment, request for payment.
Implied representations.
Stick with my. So there's two assumptions in my hypothetical. Number one, that these two cases don't resolve it. And number two, that the government can't rely on the express representations because they weren't part of the request for payment. So with those two things in mind, and as I said, you may be right, but what's the best argument you've got for the proposition that we nevertheless have a False Claims Act case? I thought you said it was because there is evidence in the record that they knew about the conflicts and that the government viewed it as significant. That is, it wouldn't have paid.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's your argument, right?
It was a demand for payment,
okay,
coupled with knowingly withholding,
okay,
information that,
okay,
was critical to the government's payment decision.
Second question, different subject, about the damages. You say in your brief that there's no way to calculate the value the government got when you have an intangible like a consulting contract like this, right?
That's tainted by conflicts of interest, yes, Your Honor.
Yeah. Well, what's your answer to what the Counsel for Science Applications said in his response to my question? He said, first of all, there is evidence in the record that that the services the government received were of value and free of a conflict.
Your Honor, what the draft report that SAIC is referring to was provided under the contract, and it was antithetical to the service that was supposed to be provided under the contract. SAIC had to do two things here. The report it's talking about had to meet two separate and distinct requirements. First, the report had to be technically proficient, and we're not disputing that element. But it also had to be free from the potential for bias, and that element was just as important as the
first. But the instruction took that question away from the jury. The instruction did not allow the jury to ask whether or not the services were or were not free of a conflict. The instruction says your calculation of damages should not attempt to account for the value of services.
That's right, and we think that's completely correct for two interrelated reasons. As a matter of law, we think a report like this that is just thoroughly infected by an organizational conflict of interest in the False Claims Act sense has no value. But also intertwined with that, it's almost a metaphysical question to ask what the value is.
But why I understand your point that it may have no value because it may in fact be infected with a conflict, but isn't it possible that, you know, some aspect of this work was both high quality and not in any way, I mean, maybe it had nothing to do with, you know, the what happens to these materials after they get into the private, you know, market. Maybe, you know, I mean, is it impossible that, so it's impossible then that, under the government's view, that it could be a value? I guess I don't understand.
Yes, Your Honor, what is the value of expert judgment, expert right. discretion, expert analysis mm-hmm. that after the fact is shown to be thoroughly
Did the government discard everything they'd done mm-hmm. and start over from zero?
Did the government do that?
Did the government
no.
do that? No.
But the government,
ergo, there was some use to what had been produced, right?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree with that.
The government can't disagree with both those statements. I mean,
let me try, Your Honor.
The government did not start over with zero. It started with something it had in hand from that product.
Yes, but
all right, having done so, having not thrown it away, having started with it, it has some value.
No, Your Honor.
That doesn't make any sense.
Well, if I can explain, Your Honor.
I wish you could, yeah.
We had this draft report
yeah.
that was tainted by a conflict of interest, and with neither time nor money are available in infinite supply, and what the agency tried to do in an ad hoc way is to sort of muddle through and, you know, salvage the situation. But let's be clear, the NRC never...
Right, had a salvage value.
No, it tried. But
doesn't make any sense. Either you threw it away and started over, or it had a value.
No, because you can try to salvage it and still get nowhere.
Throw it away after you muddled through it?
Yeah, after you muddled through it, yeah.
No, but, Your Honor, the...
Counsel, you're not going to get anywhere with that.
But even today, Your Honor, the NRC has not got to the point where it was entitled to be after this contract, which is to have an independent, neutral, objective, dispassionate third party.
So it didn't have as much value as it should have had.
Your Honor,
that doesn't mean it has zero value.
Your Honor, what is the value? It's like saying, what is the value of a baseball umpire's services if it turns out after he had an undisclosed relationship with a manager of one of the teams?
Do you go?
Well, but suppose there was evidence that the particular call was absolutely right.
But what is that? No.
It was a strike.
No,
It was a clear strike.
That's
saw
the
it on
whole
television.
Point. No, that's
you
the whole.
You wouldn't throw that out.
No, that's the whole point,
not.
Your
that's
Honor.
That's the point here.
You can't go back and say, how would the judgment have been exercised in the absence of the conflict?
You play the game over completely?
No. Yes. I mean, that, Your Honor,
if you have one
that's
of those
what you'd have to do.
Tractatrons that shows that it was right down the middle and he called it a strike.
There is no way to go back in these circumstances and recreate the judgments that would have been made.
Okay, thank you, Counsel. Unless my colleagues have further questions.
I'm just curious about this baseball question. So, your view is that if it turns out, umpire calls a strike, right? And it turns out that he's the pitcher's brother, right? That you would throw out that call, even though It was dead on, a strike on television?
What does throwing out the call mean, Your Honor? You have to throw out the game. The game would have to be replayed.
Well, okay.
Thank you, counsel.
That can't be right.
We'll hear from the appellant in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Can I just ask you a question before you start? What's your response to counsel's argument that what protects this from getting out of hand is clear jury instructions about materiality and knowledge? That is, it isn't just every government obligation. It's only requirements that can be shown, that the government can show, A, the contractor knew it was violating, and B, they were material to payment. In other words, payment would not have been made had the government known that. Doesn't that
materiality and knowledge are separate requirements under the False Claims Act.
Right.
The claim has to be false.
Right.
Right. Now, and by the way, in answer to a question that you were asking about TDC,
yeah.
TDC does not resolve it, does not remotely resolve
it.
TDC does not even mention the Sywick case.
Yeah, you're right about that.
It is not an implied, implicit conditions case at all.
Right. Okay.
And so what we're saying is that the government, if it wishes to impose a condition, it can do exactly what this court said in the Sywick case. And by the way, the question that you were asking with respect to government benefits and whether the Sywick case was talking about funding or not, the Sywick case goes on to cite the earlier Harrison case, which talks about continued funding. It cites the Columbia HCA case, and this is in the same paragraph, which talks about before receiving funds before liability can attach. It talks about receiving government benefits. I submit that the Sywick case, first of all, says this is a non-starter, but if it is, if it's going to be used, it has to be something that is explicit. Now, with respect to whether or not it was
explicit. CWAC didn't have to resolve that, given the fact that 207 wasn't even a condition of the contract. That's my only point about CWAC.
What I think you do have to resolve is whether or not, if the government's going to recover under the punitive provisions of the False Claims Act, the claim has to violate some explicit or known or clear condition contained in the contract, regulation, or the statute.
Right, and in CWAC, it wasn't in any way an obligation of the contract. Wasn't built into it.
Well, certainly the arguments were made that it was fundamental to what was done, and I guess
part of the contract.
I might invite your attention to the second Harrison case, which is a Fourth Circuit case, which involved briefing by the United States government. It involved the Department of Energy. It involved alleged conflicts of interest, and that court goes into the same kind of analysis here and requires that the conditions be articulated. And with respect to whether or not there was a requirement, on page 764 of the joint appendix, the government official was asked, is there any provision in the 1999 contract that tells SAIC if you're not in compliance with the OCI provisions of this contract, you will not get paid? Is there any provision in that contract that tells you if you're not in compliance, you won't get paid? Answer, no. That's the government official with respect to that subject. With respect to the issue of collective knowledge, the instruction with respect to is inconsistent with what I was hearing the government attorney say. The instructions on page JA-963, a corporation is liable for the collective knowledge of all employees and agents within the corporation. There are 45,000 employees at this company, by the way. Therefore, the judge instructed, if a corporation has many employees or agents, you must consider the knowledge possessed by those employees and agents as if it was added together and combined into one collective pool of information. I could go on, but that's what the jury was instructed was a predicate for finding of liability. So even notwithstanding what the government's responses were here during the argument, that is what the jury was instructed. They added every single employee together, whether they spoke to one another or not, and it's clear that one of them had issues with respect to the DOE and the NRC, and another one filled out the claims and so forth.
Let me ask you about the clarity of that contract. You were saying in your brief and in your opening that there was no way for them to know that working with the DOE contractors would be a conflict with NRC. Counsel for the government says, well, look, they knew they were dealing with the same issue and that they were on another side of the same issue. Why wasn't that sufficient to make the conflict rather clear?
I don't think they were on the other side of the same issue. All the testimony is that the work done by SAIC did not involve a taint in their direction. But secondly, the issue, SAIC was...
Even if they were not on the other side, they knew they were dealing with a contractor who had the same issues, didn't they?
In the broadest possible sense, that might be true, but SAIC was concerned.
It's another way of saying that might be true.
Well, depending upon how broad you define the universe, yes, it did have to do with recycling of radioactive materials. But SAIC was concerned about that when it entered into these contracts in 1992 and 1999 because they already had relationships with DOE contractors. They didn't want to conflict themselves out of that. They asked, these are at public hearings. The record will show that, indeed, these questions were raised specifically on public hearings, on the record. The transcripts are available and part of record in this case, and the answers that the NRC people gave is essentially, don't worry about the Department of Energy, this is a separate agency. Now, I'm paraphrasing, I'm not using the exact words, but the test isn't, did they know for sure? The test is, this is an ambiguous regulation. Was it a plausible construction of the regulation based upon possible ambiguity added by the DOE officials and the NRC officials themselves? Was that, under this court's standard, a plausible interpretation? It was. One final point.
Make it quick, because I think we once again have gone beyond. Well, we talked everybody today well beyond their time, so finish yours up.
I will finish it this way, that the government in five respects wants to expand the False Claims Act. It wants a liability under the False Claims Act if there's a false statement, whether or not there's a false claim. They want to have a liability under the False Claims Act if any information is omitted, which might be critical. They want to attach knowledge of every single employee of a big corporation together. They want to impose False Claims Act liability if there's any violation of any background regulation. And they want to impose liability if the government, even in any case where the services were intangible, and disregard the value of the work.
I'm going to stop it right there, then. We're way past on all times.
Thank you, counsel.
Given the number of people involved and my suspicion that a lot of them have to do with this case, we might be wise to take a recess before calling the next case. So give us a recess. This case is submitted, and give us recess.